Hello there. Today is Friday, December the 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Speaker of the House of Representatives announces Congress will move forward to officially impeach President Donald Trump.
Our democracy is what is at stake. The president leaves us no choice but to act because he is trying to corrupt once again the election for his own benefit.
North Korea appears to potentially be ramping up its nuclear efforts. Also ahead, she won't be the halftime act in the Super Bowl, but Lady Gaga will make an appearance the day before. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, speaking in somber tones in a televised statement, House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi held a brief morning address on Thursday before television cameras, warning that American democracy is at stake, directed a House committee to draft articles of impeachment against President Trump, a historic step that sets up a fight over whether to oust him from office. She accused the president of abusing his power for his own personal benefit at the expense of national security.
Our democracy is what is at stake. The president leaves us no choice but to act because he is trying to corrupt once again the election for his own benefit. The president has engaged in abuse of power, undermining our national security and jeopardizing the integrity of our elections. His actions are in defiance of the vision of our founders and the oath of office that he takes to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Sadly, but with confidence and humility, with allegiance to our founders and a heart full of love for America, today I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment.
Well, she cited Trump's pressuring Ukraine to seek dirt on his Democratic political rivals while he withheld military aid and a White House meeting sought by that country's new president. But staunch Trump ally Senator Lindsey Graham shot down the entire process.
The speaker said it should be bipartisan, it should be prayerful, it should be thoughtful. So what happened? You had four law professors give their opinion for one day in the Judiciary Committee, and she's directing articles of impeachment being drafted. That tells you all you need to know.
And President Trump also questioned Democrats' loyalty to the country.
These people, you almost question whether or not they love our country. And that's a very, very serious thing.
The Republicans have accused Democrats of hating the president and wanting to find any reason to impeach him. And that accusation played out in real time Thursday as Nancy Pelosi was finishing up her conference. And we will now talk to Claire Finkelstein, faculty director with the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Democrats said it's Congress's job to provide oversight on the White House and that this is their only avenue possible to hold the president accountable. Thank you for being with us. Is this accurate?
Under our current law, there is no other way to hold a president accountable. There's a Department of Justice policy not to indict a sitting president. And since the president may have violated the law, but he would not be accountable under criminal process, impeachment is the only way to go in order to discipline that behavior, signal to future presidents that what he did is not permissible, and eventually to remove him from office for violating the law.
The Republicans had a lot of objections to whether or not this even holds any merit. They said the process has been unfair, that it's basically one person did say it's a partisan witch hunt. They said they don't have any firsthand witnesses. They just had a lot of objections about the process. What do you say?
The Republican objection on process fundamentally misconceives the nature of the impeachment inquiry. There's a misunderstanding about the process in that, because this body, the House, does not have the ability to remove this president. What they are doing is laying out their case. The Senate would be the body to remove the president. And so, in theory, the Republicans should be happy if the Democrats are not laying out a strong enough case, because it means that the impeachment will fail in the Senate.
They're arguing that the evidence put forward and the actions by the president do not warrant impeachment even in an inquiry. Apparently, that's at least my perception of what I'm hearing.
That's right. That's what they believe. Interestingly, they're making objections to not having fact witnesses brought before the Judiciary Committee at the same time that they're arguing there's not enough evidence for impeachment. Those positions are somewhat contradictory because if the committee were to bring fact witnesses, they would presumably sound a lot like the fact witnesses that were brought before the Intelligence Committee, and the evidence would mount up. Moreover, there's a problem because the president himself has forbidden Mulvaney from testifying. And so if you then conclude, well, there's not enough evidence to impeach, you're basically saying that the president's obstruction worked. He can keep witnesses from appearing in front of House committees and thereby make it impossible to impeach himself because there's not enough evidence.
How does this case differ from previous impeachments of our presidents?
Well, I think the most striking contrast between this case and previous impeachments is with Nixon. Because once the clear evidence came out with Nixon, evidence of his involvement with the break-in, evidence of his involvement in covering up the break-in, and then finally the existence of the tapes and the missing segment of tape, and it was clear what had happened, Nixon knew that he could not garner support of the country anymore. There was a kind of, okay, I tried to cover it up, you guys found out, and I'm done. Of course, a bunch of Republican senators came to him and said, Mr. President, we cannot support you anymore once the evidence came out. The deep difference here is that these Republicans appear to be entrenched in their views and their determination to support the president no matter what evidence comes out. So one does not have the feeling that if there were fact witness called, more evidence compiled, that they are open to changing their views. And I think that's a big difference with regard to the Nixon impeachment.
But they also argue that this is a complete partisan basic witch hunt on the Democratic side, that the Democrats have wanted to impeach this president since he got into office.
And of course, that was claimed in the Nixon impeachment, too. But once the facts were out, and it was clear what Nixon had done, and in particular, his efforts to obstruct justice were clear. There was so much shock on the part of the country that it was clear his presidency couldn't stand. Whereas in this case, the administration has alternated between trying to deny the facts, but also saying that even if the facts are true, it doesn't much matter. Think of Mick Mulvaney's comment, just get used to it. And I fear that the American people have started to get used to it, and that things that used to shock us no longer shock.
Democrats have been in a pretty big push to have this done as quickly as possible, which was another complaint by the Republicans. But the Democrats are arguing that this is literally a matter of democracy and the rule of law and saving our democracy. And are they exaggerating?
I think it would have been helpful for them to explain why the rule of law is so critical to maintaining a democracy. It is critical because if we run our government by the mere power of men, then those individuals are not constrained in any way by law. What the rule of law means, what living in a rule of law society means, is that power is constrained at all times by law, so that the exercise of power on the part of the president, on the part of other executive branch officials, and even on the part of Congress takes place entirely according to rules, laws, and moral practices that help determine what ways people can act and what ways it is forbidden for them to act. And if you don't have a mechanism for holding individuals accountable for violating those laws, then you no longer have a rule of law society. Therefore, you no longer have a democracy.
All right, that's Claire Finkelstein. She is the faculty director for the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Thank you so much for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. France has shut down a mass strike, or France shuts down, basically, because of a mass strike hitting trains and the Eiffel Tower and flights. Israel's prime minister calls for more action against Iran. U.S. and U.K. officials announced charges against two Russian hackers, and how Baby Shark is helping save the Navajo language. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. North Korea is threatening to resume insults of President Donald Trump if he keeps saying things to provoke the North, AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
North Korea is threatening to go back to calling President Donald Trump a dotard. Pyongyang says it will resume insults of Trump and consider him a dotard if he keeps using provocative language, such as referring to its leader as Rocket Man. The North's first vice foreign minister issued the warning via state media days after Trump spoke of possible military action toward the North and revived his nickname for ruler Kim Jong-un. The officials said North Korea will respond with its own harsh language if Trump again uses such phrases and shows he is intentionally provoking North Korea. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Uganda's president led a march against corruption Wednesday, but critics were quick to dismiss the march as a public stunt. Uganda has one of the worst rankings in the world for corruption, with activists pointing fingers at the highest levels of government. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni on Wednesday led hundreds of people in a march against corruption, calling corrupt people parasites who steal public wealth. Museveni said to end corruption, leaders must develop the economy.
Commercial agriculture, industry, services and job and ICT. Because that's how we can create jobs and wealth and income, so that our people do not have a material basis for acute need which forces them to be corrupt.
But critics note that last year, Transparency International ranked Uganda as one of the most corrupt countries in Africa, below Kenya, Mauritania, and Nigeria. Action Aid International Uganda says Museveni marching against corruption is ironic, as his government is to blame for much of it.
He is the chief law enforcement officer of Uganda. He's therefore the one whom the citizens are supposed to walk and show and demonstrate that they are angry about corruption. Now, to whom is he angry? So we really think that he's playing politics.
Critics accuse Uganda's Inspector General of only holding lower-level officials or private citizens to account for corruption. The inspector acknowledged that some top government officials hide behind Museveni, but argues the president is sincere in tackling corruption.
You see, when he says, I am ready to fight, it means he's ready to give them up. So that if you start looking for them, and to be true to him, if you are investigating a person who is near him, he doesn't say stop investigating. He says, bring me the evidence.
But Uganda's Deputy Speaker of Parliament, Jacob Olanya, says he is not convinced that corruption is now at the top of Museveni's agenda.
Unless we take this from our own front lines and extend the frontier to cover other areas, it's a waste of time. It's a public show for nothing. I come because it's a public show. But deep down, I know we are going right back to practice the same damn corruption that we claim to fight.
Nonetheless, Uganda's lawmakers and judges Wednesday renewed public vows to be honest and not accept bribes. The anti-corruption events blocked all roads leading to central Kampala, forcing many skeptical passers-by to walk for over 6 kilometers to get to work. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Well, as world leaders continue to meet in Spain at this year's COP25, or Conference of Parties, this year's summit is expected to focus on fine-tuning the rules for reducing fossil fuel emissions by the roughly 200 signatories of the Paris Agreement. President Trump is dismissing climate change and has thumbed his nose at previous climate talks, twice by sending White House delegations to promote climate-degrading coal. And he is due to complete the U.S. withdrawal from the landmark Paris Global Climate Accord on November 4, 2020, the day after next year's presidential election. Experts say the U.S. has repeated about faces on the threat of climate change likely have done lasting damage. Joining us now is Brendan Guy, Manager of International Policy with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's joining us from Madrid at the conference. Thank you so much for being with us. Obviously, we know the leaders are doing the work of trying to come up with these numbers, but the numbers mean something. It's not just a number. This is more than just a political event. This is a reality for humanity, is it not? Tell us about what really matters here under the surface here.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And sometimes these negotiations can get a little divorced from reality, but I think it's important to step back and see the broader picture of what the science is demanding that we do to act on climate change. You know, we're seeing the mounting impacts both at home and abroad. So what that really is telling world leaders and negotiators is that they need to first urgently step up their ambition, because their ambition is nowhere near where we need it to be to get on a safer climate trajectory. And then second, and at the same time, to implement actions immediately that correspond with those stronger ambitions, and that deploy those now is going to save us a lot of cost and a lot of heartache and pain down the road.
We hear a lot about it will be catastrophic, we're almost at the point of no return. We hear things like that. What does the science say, and what are the specific impacts that are so dire that we should be concerned about?
So the science is becoming clearer and clearer. It's always been fairly clear, but it only continues to get more precise. And so what that has said is that globally, we need to reduce our emissions by about half in the next decade to be on a safer climate trajectory, and that by mid-century, so 2050, we need to be on a track for net zero emissions. That means any emissions that are emitted also need to be sequestered in some way, whether through natural solutions or other technological solutions. And in terms of the impacts that we're seeing already, you know, there's a lot of talk about how climate change is going to be, you know, a severe threat in the future and have impacts on our livelihoods. I think people are seeing that already, and it's happening even faster than the scientists predicted, whether you look at wildfires in California or flooding in Florida or the typhoon that's slamming into the Philippines, the 20th one they've had this year. I think those impacts are becoming increasingly real. People are finding it very unusual and really hard to deny that there's something wrong here and that leaders need to be doing something about it.
What can happen if this continues?
The risks are pretty dire. I mean, it's a continuum of impacts. Every degree of warming matters, but also within those degrees of warming, there are tipping points. So it could unleash certain consequences that are very difficult to control. So the impacts really do depend on where you live, but that could be everything from having storm surges coming into your home, to hurricanes, completely obliterating your communities, to having all sorts of desertification that affects foods and crops and availability to get water. You know, it really does affect all the kind of vital life support systems that humans depend on, and the severity and kind of the frequency of those impacts are really just going to depend on where you happen to live in the globe. But we do know they're going to hit the poorest and the most vulnerable first and hardest.
Right. And of course, we have immigration issues. A lot of nations now we're seeing don't want to welcome refugees, but it sounds like we're going to have a bigger refugee crisis, which could also lead to a national security crisis.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that's one of the issues I know leaders are very attuned to, is this increasing climate impact and shock that does make populations go on the move, and that does have destabilizing effects. So there are many imperatives for taking action on climate change, but for the security-minded folks who may be a little more reluctant or a little more hesitant, I think that argument is becoming increasingly clear.
So you're saying, basically, underneath it all, we have all this mounting science and all these warnings that these things are already starting to happen, that they need to be sped up substantially, not just to talk about it or say, what should we do, or a number here. Obviously, we know there's been sort of a disconnect between the science and the people that will feel the impacts the most, which are the young people, with the people that are running these governments that are concerned about things like economic issues, but don't realize that they may get more money in the short term from oil, but ultimately...
I think the disconnect is real, and that's why we are seeing young people in the streets and people of all stripes from all walks of society in the streets and demanding that their world leaders step up to this challenge in a much bolder way than they have already.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in terms of the economics, that is, the kind of conservative traditional mindset that a lot of leaders are still stuck in, that they're just beginning to emerge out of right now, is that the old economics of fossil fuels is actually very quickly being replaced by the economic opportunities and the lower cost of renewables. Even just in the last couple of years, it has accelerated just at a dramatic rate. And so I think getting the leaders to wrap their heads around how those economics have changed and the economic opportunity to be competitive in the global clean energy industry, to attract and build those kinds of clean, sustainable jobs that can't be outsourced, that is the economic opportunity to be seized. But then on the flip side, there is the risk, as we have been talking about, of if we don't get a good handle on climate change, that will seriously be disruptive to economies, to national finances, to, you know, even kind of fiscal matters. Governments will have to spend an increasing percentage of their budget just responding to climate change impacts. So I think it's both on the opportunity and on the risk side.
Do we know how to do it? Do we have the technology and the technological understanding of how to get to these goals?
We absolutely do. We have the technologies. We know how to do it. The only ingredient that's missing is political will and leadership, and that is what we do not have right now. So the solutions are clear. They're in front of us. They're getting cheaper every day. It's deploying large amounts of renewable energy. It's electrifying everything, including transportation, making transportation cleaner and using cleaner fuels. And it's having natural climate solutions like protecting forests, restoring forests, protecting our soils and agricultural soils. All of these options are at hand. Their costs are coming down every day. And so it really is just a matter of political leaders seizing them and actually implementing the policies to accelerate that transition to a cleaner future.
All right. That's Brendan Guy, Manager of International Policy with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He is in Madrid for the Climate Summit. Thanks for being with us. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump, again, as we said, is making the annual UN-sponsored climate talks underway in Madrid, one of the last ones for participation by the United States, which is the world's number one economy and the second biggest carbon emitter. Although the U.S. served formal notice last month, it intends to become the first country to withdraw from the accord. It technically remains a participant until next November 4th. Experts say the United States has repeated about faces on the threat of climate change, likely have done lasting damage. Bleak news from the Centers for Disease Control shows that Americans are dying younger and that life expectancy in the U.S. is down. So could it be time to call dogs to the rescue? VOA's Carol Pearson reports that research on dogs may help us reverse the aches and pains of aging.
Good job.
Dogs are so attuned to humans that many people think of them as family.
I can't imagine, you know, my life without them. So they're just, you know, they're just a central point part of my life.
Come on, girl. Let's go.
According to a pet owner survey, there are some 90 million pet dogs in the United States. The University of Washington is recruiting 10,000 of them for a study on aging.
The goal is to follow dogs for their entire lives, young, old, big, small, males, females, all dogs all around the U.S., to understand how the biology and the environment shape healthy aging in dogs.
The university is partnering with veterinarians at Texas A&M University.
By studying aging in pet dogs living in human environments, we can learn things that will translate to human health as we age in a shorter period of time, and will also directly benefit companion dogs along the way, which is extremely important to me as a veterinarian.
Dogs and humans age in much the same way. They have a similar genome and get the same diseases. As pets, they also share our environment. Researchers will look for lifestyle factors that also affect humans, such as diet, activity level, and where the dog lives, in addition to genetics and medical history. One of the goals is to find out how to prevent age-related diseases.
Traditionally, in medicine, we have waited until people are sick, and then we try to do something about it. We try to cure their disease, or we try to at least alleviate the symptoms. The goal here is really to keep dogs and people healthy as long as possible before they get sick. And I think that this is kind of a really important aspect of targeting the biology of aging directly rather than targeting individual diseases as they happen.
The data will be available to all scientists to encourage research on improving old age for both humans and dogs. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa,
around the world, and in our lives.
Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Betty Gethard, a resident of the state of California, is not the retiring type. In fact, the 86-year-old found a hobby where she flies through the air, apparently without a care in the world. But she says the hobby has helped her deal with one of the toughest times in her life. Jenia Dulow has the story.
Betty Gethard has been fascinated with trapeze artists since she was a child, and her parents took her to a circus performance. Gethard had always been an athlete. She started ice skating when she was 8 and toured professionally for decades. After Betty's husband died, she tried being a rock climber to get herself out of a funk.
It just gets your brain thinking about what you're doing instead of where you are. You know, I just was sad. I was just sad that I no longer had what I had. But I'm doing something that's kind of fun, kind of impossible, kind of out of my comfort zone. But at the end of the day, I could sleep at night peacefully without feeling sad.
9 years ago for her birthday, Gethard's friends gave her a coupon to go to the trapeze high school to have a free lesson.
I was scared. Everybody's scared. I mean, it's normal to be scared because it's out of your comfort zone. But, that's kind of a wonderful feeling.
Instructor Dave Ayers, who was helping her that first time, says he was terrified Gethard might fall.
It's a safe sport, but old ladies fall down, break their hip, and then fall down. That was the focus in the beginning, just making sure she didn't get hurt.
But thanks to her sporting pass, her self-discipline and patience, Gethard excelled at this new project. 8 years after she first set her eyes on a trapeze, she made it into the 2019 Guinness Book of World Records as the oldest performing female trapeze artist.
But I'm hoping, though, that people see me and say, well, I'm no different than anybody else. You know, I've been blessed with good health. But why can't I do that if she did it?
Gethard believes that anyone who wants to achieve something in his or her life needs to keep the faith and practice endlessly. After all, she says, a winner is a former loser who simply tried one more time. And looking at Gethard, you know these are not just words. Jenia Dulow for VOA News, Escondido, California.
Lady Gaga's record-breaking National Football League halftime show at the Super Bowl in 2017 was a day to remember and has been a tough act to follow, but she's returning the night before for AT&T's 10th annual Super Saturday Night Concert the day before the upcoming Super Bowl, this coming or next February 1st. The Oscar-winning singer will headline the show in the event that will be live-streamed as well via AT&T's Twitter account. Past performers have included Taylor Swift, Jay-Z, Beyonce, Jennifer Lopez, and many other big names. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA.